COVID and government's responses to COVID will continue to be a subject of debate for a very long time. Did the virus come from a lab? Was it a biological weapon? Did it leap from an animal to a human? These are all questions that we'll likely never have a clear answer to. But what we do know is that poor leadership at all levels of government and in the private sector resulted in the unnecessary illnesses and deaths of an untold number of people. And there were very few places where the situation was worse than in prisons. I'm John Kiriakou. Welcome to The Whistleblowers. In my personal writings, I regularly discuss the situation in American prisons and jails, which is, in many cases, third world. The United Nations has deemed the U.S. practice of using solitary confinement as a punishment, for example, to be a form of torture. That's not our topic today. Today, our topic centers around very poor management of prisons, management that is so poor that the lives of both prisoners and staff members was put at risk. And rather than admit to a mistake, many prison and jail administrators simply doubled down and refused to admit that they were wrong in the way that they handled the COVID pandemic. Today, we're going to tell you about a human disaster that unfolded in Dallas, Texas, and about a single detention officer who stood up to administrators and blew the whistle as loudly as he could. We're joined today by Emmanuel Lewis. He's a detention service officer at the Suzanne Lee Kays Detention Facility of the Lou Sterritt Justice Center in Dallas, Texas. It was Emmanuel Lewis who brought a class action lawsuit against the Dallas County Sheriff, alleging the sheriff allowed conditions in the county jail that promoted the spread of COVID-19 and put officers at extreme risk. Emmanuel, thanks for being with us. We're so happy to have you.
Thank you for having me, John.
The U.S. media were replete with articles about the rapid spread of COVID-19 through the U.S. prison system at every level, that is, federal, state, and local, throughout the pandemic. Prisoner deaths spiked, and many prisoners who were considered to be a low threat were eventually released to serve the remainder of their prison sentences at home. But prison employees were not so lucky. They had to remain on the job, and as more and more of them got sick, the ones who weren't had to work double and triple shifts, further exposing them to the virus. Emmanuel, take us back to the start of the COVID pandemic. What was the initial response by prison administrators and the sheriff to the outbreak?
Yeah, initially, we saw a lot of incarcerated getting sick, and also workers were getting sick. And the initial response is there was no response. We weren't given masks. We weren't given sanitizers. We're even told, don't put on any masks because it might spook the inmates. The incarcerated, they also did not have any masks. There was no thought of our safety and the incarcerated's safety. I can recall a lady being forced to go into a tank that was quarantined. That means they had the COVID virus. And she was worried about her four young kids that she had at home, and she started crying, knowing that she might bring that home to her little kids.
Many detention officers were forced to work 16-hour shifts for five or even six consecutive days at a time. But again, they were often exposed to the COVID virus, which was raging through the prison and jail systems. In Dallas, detention officer Portia Bookman was one example. She didn't want to work these long shifts, but she was forced to. And then 19 days after being forced onto the schedule, she died of COVID. She was just 36 years old. 5 days earlier, detention officer Darren Finney also died of COVID, leaving two young children behind. What was the response from administrators when detention officers began dying? What did they do to protect your health?
There was no response. We kept on having to do these mandated days, and we were warning them and telling them that we could not do it, and that more people were going to get infected, more people were going to get sick. At the jail, there's a lot of incarcerated that overstay their time. They're supposed to be out, and yet they get lost in the system, and they don't get out in time. we had one gentleman who was in there, passed his time for 5 years without even going to court.
Good Lord. Several detention officers told the media in Dallas that they had been forced and intimidated by the sheriff into working 5 consecutive days of 16-hour shifts at a time. One became so exhausted that he crashed his car on his way home after the 4th day, and he was almost killed. A doctor then recommended that all detention officers have at least 12 consecutive hours of rest between shifts, but that never happened. And in fact, the officer involved in the crash was told that if he wouldn't work the 16-hour shifts, then he wouldn't work, period. So what happened then?
The threats continued, and we weren't even allowed to have time off to go to the doctors to see if we were infected, to see if we had COVID. They did not take our temperatures. They did not test us. People were afraid to say, you know, they had COVID because their time would not even be approved off, and you'd get threatened to be written up.
Can you expand on that a little bit? What were the actual punishments? What was the fallout that you had to endure?
A lot of it, you get threatened with write-ups, and you get threatened with losing your job all the time that you do not do what they want to do, even if it's a violation of the labor law, even though you know that you cannot do your job. In these tanks, there's up to 64 incarcerated. There's only supposed to be 48 folks in there. And what they do is these tanks, a lot of them were built for minimum security. What they do is they throw the medium security in there, maximum security in there, and behavioral observation in there. And you're in there exhausted and not able to do your job and manage a tank with so many people.
You made a comment to the Dallas media that I think is very important. You said this, quote, "The inmates aren't getting quality care. If they're in a fight, they're not getting quality response time. That's not good for their safety. They're not getting cleaning supplies they need. They're not getting to go to court when they need to," unquote. To me, that sounds like the entire system was falling apart. Was it rectified in an appropriate manner? And what was the response from the administration?
There was no response. We were short-staffed, 160 officers. And that means, you know, you can't feed correctly. You can't watch the medications correctly when the nurse comes in. You can't get them in court. A lot of the services, sanitation, you know, getting them, boxers and, you know, pants. It's just created a really unjust, unfair system. And what they were also doing is they were using some of the immigrants to do a lot of the cleaning. So you'd have a tank go into quarantine, COVID, and they would just shift these incarcerated around, and then they would have immigrants come in and clean up the feces, clean up the puke, clean up the mats that they don't change often enough. And it was just creating this environment where everyone was just getting infected.
Were there any deaths among prisoners? We know that there were deaths certainly among staff. What about the prisoners?
A year before, I spoke up a year before all these deaths starting to happen because I was knowing that this was going to happen. And then we started to have some deaths, and they didn't release this information right away. We had to find out later.
We're speaking with Emmanuel Lewis, a detention service officer at the Dallas jail. Lewis had the courage during the COVID pandemic to grab the bull by the horns and lead a federal lawsuit alleging that administrators put the lives of staff and prisoners at risk for no apparent reason, resulting in multiple deaths. We're going to ask him about that lawsuit when we come back. Stay tuned.
Position, I was suggesting we bomb Belgrade. I was suggesting that we send American pilots in and blow up all the bridges on the Drina.
Vranje je bilo zasipano bombama danima, ali ne ovakvim vrstom municije. Oni su taj relej rušili, umesto klasičnim naoružanjem, rušili su uranijumom.
Koja opasnost nismo znali tad?
Mi nismo ni znali da je gađano s osiromašenom uranijum.
It may be, a lot less radioactive than something that's active uranium, but still it's radioactive and it has toxins in it that can kill you.
NATO i Amerikanci su izvršili genocid i ekocid nad ovim gradom i nad ovim ljudima ovde.
I was suggesting we bomb Belgrade.
To je bilo haos, stravota i užas.
What is Bharat? Is it a travel ad? Is it a Bollywood poster? Is it the deepest yoga center in the world? Or is it something deeper, more complex, multifaceted? Let's talk without cliches. Let's talk Bharat.
In 1941, with the Nazis' help, Croatian ultranationalists, the Ustashas, proclaimed the independent state of Croatia. Shortly after seizing power, they built the Jasenovac concentration camp, a place associated with the worst atrocities committed in Yugoslavia during World War II. The Ustashas used the camp system to isolate and exterminate Serbs, Roma, Jews and other non-Catholic minorities and political opponents of their fascist regime. Conditions in the Jasenovac camp were horrendous. The guards tortured, terrorized, and murdered prisoners.
They sent them in concentration camps. So most of them died. It was incredible genocide.
Welcome back to The Whistleblowers. I'm John Kiriakou. We're speaking with Emmanuel Lewis, a detention service officer from Dallas, Texas, who blew the whistle against the sheriff's department handling of jail facilities and personnel during the COVID pandemic. Emmanuel, thanks again for being with us.
Thank you for having me, John.
Emmanuel, you testified in a federal class action lawsuit against the Dallas County Sheriff in 2020. I know whistleblowers. I know a lot of whistleblowers. And I know a very, very few who are brave enough to take on their bosses in federal court, no less, while still serving under them. How did you come to the decision to take this action? Did you do anything before going to court? Did you make any internal complaints?
Yes, I made a lot of internal complaints and filed it all the way up, and only to be ignored. And then one day I saw a flurry of activity that they were trying to do some cleaning, that they were trying to bring in sanitation, they were trying to change some of the mats, and then I learned that there was a lawsuit going on between the management and incarcerated, and that there was no one speaking on behalf of the workers. So I saw this as an opportunity where I can give my input. Because a lot of the solutions, as you know, John, it comes from the people that are on the ground that see the problems and can offer solutions.
What was that response when you went with proposed solutions? Were you at least entertained? Did they at least listen to what you had to say? Or did they literally just ignore you?
Yeah, they literally ignored me, and then they started to retaliate against me. Wasn't able to get my vacation time, and when I finally got my vacation time, they told the fellow workers that I took time off, that I wasn't approved. It was a divide and conquer kind of strategy. They would yell at me over the radio to make it look like I was doing something wrong. And we had a lieutenant mention that she didn't care about no ACLU, she didn't care about no courts, she didn't care about any lawsuits. And she said this into the detail meeting where myself and about 40 to 50 other officers were.
Good grief. You also filed a class action lawsuit in state court in which you made some very specific allegations. In part, you said that the sheriff's policies put both officers and the incarcerated at extreme risk. There was no social distancing in the jail. The 64-person pods were filled to capacity. There was poor hygiene and inadequate cleaning. There was no COVID testing for either staff or prisoners. And those officers who did test positive had their workers' compensation claims denied. In fact, one Dallas County Human Resources representative proudly declared that he was denying 99.9% of workers' compensation claims related to COVID. How in the world was this allowed to happen? What explanations did you and other detention officers receive?
We didn't receive any explanations, and the state joined against us. And a lot of it, when you're a worker or incarcerated there, there's nowhere to go if you have any kind of concerns. You can go up the chain of command, risking to be retaliated against, and still at the end of the day, nothing gets done. And what happened when I was working there, I became discolored. I never had all this discoloration before. And knowing now, it was heart failure. So I was working at the jail with heart failure.
Oh my God, what a story this is. The federal judge who heard the case and who heard your testimony told you to let her know if you were punished or retaliated against in any way after you appeared in her court. You had only been on the job for 7 months at that point. So this was a huge risk for you. And as it turned out, the sheriff's office did retaliate against you. Tell us about that retaliation.
Yeah, a lot of the retaliation is just denying my time, denying for me to go to the academy, because I was eligible to become a sheriff deputy, trying to pit other workers and officers against me. They sent deputies to one of my neighbors that was one of my support systems to make it seem like I was doing something wrong. Just a really abuse of power to make an example of me. For me, I was able to get employment lawyer and all these things. A lot of these other workers, like, they don't know how to, you know, do some of these things that I know how to do. So they're just trying to make me seem like a, you know, example. And when you go to try to get your claims, all your claims filed, the vendors that they use, it's just delay, and nothing gets resolved.
And where are you now in the process?
I currently have a employment case, and that's scheduled for 2024. What was good about the state case, we got management to have to do their depositions, so we have a lot of those depositions. There's some other litigation going on with the female staff who, even though they worked there 15, 20, 30 years, they were told that they couldn't have the weekends off no longer. Problems are put to outsource legal counsel, which millions of dollars are being spent on this. Even the ACLU said, if you guys had just worked with us a little, we wouldn't have had to do some of this endless litigation.
So besides the ACLU case, your case is still ongoing in state court?
The state case was eventually dismissed, but the good result of that state case was we were able to get the management under deposition, which they didn't want to get under deposition. So we have these depositions, and I have that information. A lot of them, there's links to it on the internet of these depositions where they say they didn't prepare, they didn't know, they didn't inform. That's what it says over and over on these depositions.
And what's the status of the federal suit, the one that the ACLU is involved in?
The ACL suit, what they did with that one is they dragged it out for so long that those incarcerated are no longer in the jail. So it was dismissed without prejudice. So that one will be refiled at another point.
You are 100% right. Emmanuel, were you the only one, or did you find that your colleagues wanted to join you in all this?
Yes, since I was a class action suit. I was representative of the 1,000 workers. So eventually there were folks that did want to join it. But going forward, people that wanted to make employment claims against the jail, a lot of times they could not find an employment lawyer. The EEOC was taking all these claims and they were also not doing anything. There was no union that was actively advocating for us. My attorneys went to the union and said, hey, we'll work with you. We'll bear much of the cost. We have the resources. Will you partner with us? A lot of times when there is a local union, an outside union won't come in because they don't want to step on toes. I reached out to some outside unions that were also very interested in helping us, but since there was a local union, they were not able to assist us. And lastly, I'd like to say about the solutions. The solutions are, you need advocates torn the jail, media torn the jail, elected officials torn the jail, management torn the jail. A lot of the people that were trying to make decisions on the jail, they were never inside the jail. The elected officials and management will get tired of touring the jail and they'll address some of these issues. We need a monitor like over in Mississippi and over in Rikers in those jails. Learn from other states of what they're doing. So when a loved one or a worker has a problem, they can go to an independent monitor. The FBI has had to been called in a lot at our jail. There was over $700,000 worth of commissary, which was stolen. And as you know, John, commissary is very important at the jail. So the incarcerated were bringing these complaints to us and nothing was being done. We'd forward up the complaints. And then they started blaming each other and thinking other people stole their ID, stole their information, and was starting to steal the commissary. The air quality at the jail is very bad. The mold is very bad. People, when they go into the jail, they're not searched, a lot of them. As a worker going into the jail, in my 3 years in total that I've been there, I was never searched. So you're breathing in all this toxic air, and there's a lot of workers that made complaints about that as well.
Emmanuel Lewis, thank you so much for joining us. This is an important story, incredibly enlightening. I have said many times on this show that psychologists tell us that for reasons that are really not entirely clear, whistleblowers have an unusually well-defined sense of right and wrong, far more defined than among the general public. For most whistleblowers, life is not shades of gray, it's black and white, right and wrong. The situation in the Dallas County Jail was clearly wrong. Staff and prisoners alike were fortunate to have somebody like Emmanuel Lewis standing up for them. That's what whistleblowing really is all about. I'd like to thank Emmanuel Lewis for joining us today and for telling his important story. And thanks to our viewers for being with us for another episode of The Whistleblowers. I'm John Kiriakou. We'll see you next time.